Welcome to Wood Talk Online Radio, for woodworkers by woodworkers. Now, here are the three guys who actually are under the illusion that woodworking is cool: Mark, Matt, and Shannon. You know, this new intro music makes me want to dance every time I hear it. I really, really, really like it. It's episode
dancing right now.
Yeah, you guys should be dancing when we do this. It's episode 74 for September 28th, 2010. And I have to say, I'm fresh out of the shower, nice and clean, just like you guys like me. But as far as Matt and Shannon go, not so much.
No. So. Well, actually, I just got back from getting my hairs cut, getting myself ready for WIA. So I'm all powdery around the neck.
Nice. You know what? Do you guys have to to shower when you get home from getting your hair cut? I can't stand it. Even if they like powder me up and stuff, that irritates my collar so bad. I have to take a shower.
Thank you. I'm so glad somebody else says that. I get home and I have to do the same thing. I mean, I am sprinting in the door. I am right in there, even if it's just so much as getting my head soaked so I can get all that extra hair off and around my neck. That's the only way I can tolerate it. Everybody else is like, I don't know what your problem is. I'm like, dude, it's hair. Can't you feel that?
Yeah, it's so irritating. Anyway, we actually do have some woodworking stuff to talk about today. Not just hair.
I thought this was more like the barbershop version where we're going to sit around and talk about new styles that are coming out.
And drink grape soda.
That's right. And sing four-part harmony.
We could try that. So here's what we're going to talk about today. The Woodworking in America classes that we're most looking forward to. I'm signed up for a whole bunch of them. Hopefully I'll actually get to them all.
That's like next weekend, right?
It's this weekend, right? Just making sure. Oops. That's the first time we actually had a real curse word in the show.
Bleep.
Congratulations, Shannon. Okay.
Hey, my pleasure.
Low angle versus high angle planes is another topic we'll talk about from an email that we got. I know if there's a forum topic about that. And the big question, can you live without a table saw? Which is kind of interesting. And I've seen that being discussed on multiple blogs and things like that lately, including our forum. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So before we get to all that stuff, Matt, how about you tell them how they can get in touch with us?
Absolutely. Well, you know, probably by this point, you should know that there's a couple of different ways you can get a hold of us if you ever have a comment, a question, or a suggestion about something that either you've heard in today's show or maybe something you'd like to hear on an upcoming episode. You can reach us by email at woodtalkonline@gmail.com, or you can pick up the phone and leave us a message on our voicemail at 623-242-2450. You can also find all three of us on Twitter as myself is at MBW Podcast, Mark is at Wood Whisperer, and Shannon is at Renaissance WW. And you know what? We're even on the Facebook too. So you can also catch us causing all sorts of trouble in the new forum over at woodtalkonline.com. I don't know why I keep forgetting to mention that one. I mean, that one's pretty crucial because we definitely are over there. One of us at some point, given, you know, any time during the day is in there. I've caught myself actually going in the middle of the night. I like wake up at like 1 or 2, and I'll look over at the missus, and she's out cold. So I grab my phone and go, hey, who's in the forum?
Yeah, I've got a direct neural connection, actually, that is wireless and just lets me know whenever there's a new post.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
All right, so let's head into the next thing. Mark, what do you have on your bench so we can get this whole show started? You got anything good going on?
I do. I've got some Honduran mahogany on my bench, actually. Anyone who's been watching the blog, I've been putting up a couple posts here and there, just kind of keeping people posted. I've got some beautiful Honduran that I'm working with and making a big trestle desk / table for our gaming area. So it's a big monster. It's a lot of material. I had to make, it's one of those poor planning things because I kind of planned as I went along and actually wound up making about 4 trips to the lumberyard to get the stuff that I needed to get, which is always a miserable time in the middle of summer in Arizona. So I wound up getting a lot of really heavy-duty material. The stock for the top on this piece alone is, what did I wind up with? An inch and, oh, it's over an inch and a quarter thick. So we're talking a serious, thick, heavy-duty top.
Wow.
The good thing, though, is it's a 65-inch span between the legs. The total length of the top is like 92 inches. So in order for me to span that distance without having to, you know, be too concerned about sag or anything like that, I had to go with something a little bit thicker. And I think the thickness of the top kind of blends with the sculpted legs that we're doing. So, of course, I say we, and I just mean myself, but I tend to do that a lot. So that's really what I've been focusing on, trying to get that filmed. And, wow, I mean, you guys film this stuff too. Sometimes a project you think is going to be an easy thing to film, and really there's not that much to say about it. You turn around, the next thing you know, you have tapes and tapes worth of content, and I'm on my fourth card. Typically, a card for me equates to about maybe 30, maybe at the most 40 minutes of content from that card, and I've got four cards worth now. You know, out of nowhere.
Too much.
I do talk too much. And I've had that said to me before.
Hey, actually, I have a question. How long is the desk? How long is that top?
It's 24 deep, 92 total length from side to side.
Damn.
It's long, yeah. Well, the thing is, Nicole and I, when we game, we are playing right next to each other. So it has to sit two people comfortably at a gaming, you know, system. So we have to have enough room for the computer. We've got to have enough room for leg room for two people. And we also, I mean, we eat at this table a lot. So a lot of times our gaming is based on like East Coast time. So while other people are at like 8 o'clock, we're just ready to start thinking about dinner. So it's important that we have a place to put a drink and a plate that isn't in the way. So that's kind of the concept for having a huge expansive top to be able to spread out a little bit.
That's cool.
Yeah, so it's a lot of fun, but it's been keeping me busy, and I actually think I'm pretty much done at this point. I've got a little bit of work to do tomorrow, and then I my goal was to get this done before WIA so that I can just kind of go to Ohio and enjoy myself and come back and start fresh with a new project.
Nice. Now, in the pictures you had on, this is the piece or pieces that they were lifting with a forklift. Now, yeah. Is that because it was that heavy? I mean, how did you get that in there?
This company that I go to, Spelman Hardwoods, it's just part of their policy. If I go and order an 8-foot four-quarter board of, you know, pine, they're going to put it on a forklift and bring it out to my car. It's just the way that they do things. It looks a little bit cooler, though, when you've got a big piece of, like, you know, 14-inch wide, 8-quarter stock sitting on this thing. It looks more impressive, but it's great. They actually just bring it to the back of the truck. The guy gets out of the forklift and tips it in, and you just tie it down and go into the office and pay.
I had this image of it being so big and so heavy that when you got it in the truck, suddenly your truck was lowrider and you had like the shades on. You're going, hey, Vato, what's up? I got some mahogany.
My truck already is a lowrider. No, just kidding. But yeah,
it would be if I was in the back of it.
Yeah, well, it's actually the pieces were a little bit difficult to manage. I mean, I'm not that big of a guy, so, you know, I'm not that weak either. But, you know, I picked this thing up, and normally I just pull a board and put it up on my shoulder, and this was like, okay, you know, this 14-inch wide solid Honduran mahogany 12-foot long board, that's not the easiest thing to wrangle into the shop, but it worked out okay. I made the top out of two boards, that's all.
I hope that I hope you caught that on film. I'd love to see how a power tool guy surfaces a 24-inch top.
I do it with I surface each one individually with a planer and glue them together. That's how it's done. So anyway, enough about my business and crap that I'm working on. Matt, what's the deal with this plane? Did you get this thing together yet?
It is almost 100% done. It's at the phase now. It actually looks like a plane, and the nice thing, the whole reason why I've been so slow on moving on this is because I'm slow in general.
This
was
one
of those things I was hoping to have completed by WIA also, but unfortunately it's not going to be. But I'm thinking about bringing it with me anyways, just to kind of to show how it's going.
Do it.
The infills, they have the bed angles cut for it, so they're right where they're supposed to be. I had to do a little tweaking with some sandpaper and a granite surface to get them perfectly flat and get them lined up with the mouth and the sole of the plane, and we'll see that because I'm making sure to document this whole thing, how it's going together.
Cool.
One thing I did do is I kind of jumped ahead in my instructions. In fact, what I really did, I'm going to confess this to everybody here. Please don't tell Ron this if any of you run into him. I lost one of the pages from his instructions.
Don't.
And rather than running back to the computer and printing it, which probably would have been the easiest thing, I just made an assumption on what the next step would be. So I did that, but
good
it's
idea,
working
man.
Out perfectly fine. Essentially, the part I'm skipping, and I really don't think it's going to have any effects on it because it really is in there solid. The infill itself is held by two things. One is some CA glue that
Please
will help to hold
tape.
Everything
Please
in place.
Say duct tape.
That there is some on it right now. But then the other thing is dowels, some screws that go in through the sides to help hold it in place. In fact, actually to help position it. And really, once I got those dowels in place the way I ended up doing it, they are rock solid. I've been playing around with it quite a bit, and it's not going anywhere. So not using the CA glue, I don't think it's going to have any effect, because the way the thing is designed, just using those dowels, it's going to hold it in place. And I put the blade in unsharpened and everything just to play with it. And Ron puts together an amazing kit. I cannot wait for this thing to get done. And a huge side effect I thought was really, really cool is, since I never work with exotic woods, I mean, seriously, like Pennsylvania cherry is super exotic for me.
Right.
This East Indian rosewood that I'm working with, when I cut it, not only did it look like I suddenly was like in a chocolate factory and putting sprinkles all over my shop, it gave off like this potpourri smell. So for once, rather than like wet dog, sweaty mat, my shop actually felt very fragrancy and nice, and people wanted to come in and visit. So it was pretty exciting for me.
Nice. Yeah, you know, the exotics have a incredible range of smells that they emit, and it really depends on which one you're working with, whether it's horrible or really, really pleasant.
Yeah, zebra wood.
Yeah.
Does it smell like zebra?
Yeah, wet zebra. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what was funny about this? Shannon, do you recall the last time we did Wood Talk and we asked Matt how long he thinks it would take to put one of these planes together? And I think he said it would be like just an afternoon, if I recall correctly.
I believe so.
And it's been about a month, so...
I'm thinking it takes an afternoon for Ron Breeze to put together one of these planes. So well, we might want to bump that time up a bit.
Yeah.
I well, you know, for a normal person, it would be an afternoon. But for me, an afternoon is like, you know, a week. So I seem to like only work on these for like a half an hour to 45 minutes at a shot. And then suddenly I get, Dad, I'm late for soccer practice. Oh, really?
Yeah, there's Matt time and then there's like the real world time. So
aren't you supposed to like run laps before a soccer game anyway? Just tell the kid,
I'm like, where's your mom? She's at the grocery store. Well, run to get her. That will warm you up.
There you go.
Have her take you to the field where you can play.
Nice.
One of these days, I'm going to make a great parent.
Someday. Someday.
I'm still waiting to be a great parent. I think maybe I'm going to be a better grandparent.
I'm a great parent of two beautiful little dogs.
And they're very well behaved.
They are. They're sleeping all day long. That's like the perfect kid. Just there sleeps all the time. All right. Anyway, enough about my stupid dogs. Shannon, what's on your bench, buddy?
Well, I also have a project that I had vowed to get done in time for Woodworking in America, but that's mainly because I'm going to put my tools in it to carry them there. So I keep saying I want to build a toolbox, and I just never do and never do. And I'm like the total ghetto guy that shows up for classes with like stuff in a plastic Safeway bag and socks and things like that. And,
right.
And last time I went to Chuck Bender's school, I had like this old cloth bag that like a Ryobi cordless, you know, those cordless tool packs, like four or five tools. It came with like that little shoulder bag that you kind of laugh and say, yeah, right. Like I'm going to use that. And I did, actually. So I just said, this is ridiculous. So I figured I would pull something together, and I'm kind of basing it off of, if you guys, Tom Fidgen's Made by Handbook, that cool little toolbox he did. Mine's kind of based on that same idea, and the fact that the handle kind of wraps around the case. The handle's made out of walnut and kind of wraps around the side and the bottom, but everything else is made out of cherry. I actually originally was going to make it out of this really cool piece of quarter sawn white oak. And that's kind of heavy. I actually like laid out the stock. You know, I hadn't cut anything yet, but I marked out the pieces from the stock. So, you know that the stock is going to weigh the same as the stock when you cut it apart.
Sure.
And I laid a couple of the tools on it and was doing kind of spacing. And then I tried to lift the whole thing and I was like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Not good for portability. Yeah.
Yeah. It would be kind of like, I don't know, putting your tools in like a Volkswagen Bug and trying to carry that around. It was just so blooming heavy. I mean, the toolbox itself is about 15 inches wide and 25 inches long. It's designed to hold my longest panel saw, and I could put a joiner plane in there if I wanted to, but I don't see myself taking a joiner plane on the road very much. But at least this way I can put a saw in there. So there's saws on one half and planes and stuff in the other half, and there's a little dividing thing down the middle that has holes for chisels in it. So that is actually done. I've got a coat of finish that's drying on it right now, so I'm gonna hopefully be able to put another coat of varnish over top of it tomorrow, and it should be ready to go.
Sweet.
And then I did film the whole thing, and I actually wanted to get it out in time for Woodworking America. In fact, the little opening sequence that I filmed, I said, Woodworking America is a week away. And I'm building this for Woodworking America. I'm just going to have to edit that part out because there's no way I'm going to be able to get that thing edited and posted by the time I leave.
Sure. So, all right.
Oh, well.
Bummer.
What are you going to do?
You just move on.
Yep. Yeah.
Is well, that all you got there?
That toolbox. Maybe I can you know, I'll know where exactly to go get my tools from now.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit later because I wanted to talk to you guys about what you're bringing, but we'll discuss that when we talk about the classes and stuff.
Okay.
Is that all you got there, Shannon?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's other stuff, but...
But we'll move on.
There's always projects going on. You know how it goes.
Too many projects.
Oh,
not enough
way
time,
too
right?
many. I've got a list so long that one of these days I might have to quit the show and do them.
You may as well. You may as well. Just get them done. All right, let's jump into emails. We do have two of them to talk about. And looks like Nicole just got home. So if you hear any noise, that's what that is. Okay, Rob in the Great Pacific Northwest, as he says, I'm a little confused on the difference between low angle and normal / high angle planes. Besides the obvious, what application are low angle planes used? Are normal high angle planes for removing more material and low angle for final finishing? Or is it more of the type of grain that you're removing? He says, is a fence like the one available for the Veritas low angle joiner plane a legitimate way to solve the issue of leaning to the left like Miss Carey addressed in podcast number 67? So we thought this would be a good thing to discuss on the show. Actually, if I recall correctly, I forwarded this to Shannon and Matt and said, hey, this is why you guys are on the show. Enjoy. But now we're talking about it on the show. So what do you say, guys?
I say the answer is yes.
Good, good, good. That's helpful.
Yeah, so. Same here. That was exactly my answer. I'm like, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Good job,
next
guys.
Question.
Well, I mean, first of all, let's address the easy one, the fence, the low-angle joiner plane fence. I've actually never used one of these, Matt. You've got one, don't you?
Yeah, I use it all the time. It's absolutely wonderful. It's saved a lot of skin on my knuckles, really, when it comes down to it. And it's got the hair on my head from when things don't go quite the way they're supposed to.
Right.
All right. Well, then I won't say what I was going to say about it being a useless tool.
Let's have this. Let's throw it out on this one.
You know what? We need more disagreement on this show. So you guys go ahead and have it out. Let's hear it.
I just think that first of all, when I joint edges, I usually use a cambered iron and I control the squareness of my edge by moving the plane laterally back and forth across the edge. So if like the high side is on the left, I move the deepest part of the curve over top of that. In other words, the deepest part of the curve takes a thicker shaving. And as the curve of the plane kind of tapers off to the edges of the plane, it takes a thinner shaving. So if my high side's on the left-hand side, I'll put that deep part of the blade over the left-hand side and I end up removing more of that till I get it level. I don't know. It's just one of those things that I think with training wheels like that, it will help you get, you know, good results, no question. But I think that you're selling yourself short a little bit by not learning to do it by hand, to channel your inner square. And I don't know. I think we've become kind of a tool collector nation where it's like, ooh, this is a cool tool. I want to get that. And do we really need it? You know? So, and most of the time I say, yes, I do need that tool. But this is one that I'm going to say, not so much. And I don't think it's that hard. Now I'm saying this, even though I've never used it before, I'm going to be contrary and say, no. Those are for losers.
Losers. You know who else thinks it's for losers is Adam Carabini. And I'm going to reference this blog post he made a couple times here in his discussion. He just recently put up a post that was called Tools You Don't Need. And
talk about a throwdown. That was an awesome post.
Yeah, no kidding. Adam likes to cause trouble. That's what I like about him.
I like somebody, he's a big dude. He can back it up.
Yeah. I just like somebody who's not afraid to just, you know, say what they feel and whether you care or whether you agree or not. Screw you.
I think those buckles on his shoes are actually throwing stars, so that's part of being able to back that up.
Well, you'll know if Matt comes back from WIA with a buckle print on his forehead, you know what happened. So he says in his great list here, you got to check it out. I'll put the link to this article in the show notes. But number 8, jointer fences. He says some manufacturers make these machine fences that attach to your planes to help you hold the plane square to the face. I say if you want to use a power joiner, go use it and don't feel bad about it. Slacker. No, he didn't say that. I didn't. I'm ad-libbing here. If you want to use a hand plane, learn how to square an edge, get a triplane with a cambered iron, and learn the trick, which would be what Shannon just described. So there you go.
Yeah, you heard it here first.
Oh, wow. All
Although
right. Well,
I do admit I did read Adam Carabini's blog, but that's not why I said
But I do feel like we're ganging up on Matt here a little bit. But
no, it's okay. I'm a big guy. I can bring it on. Bring it. I mean, I can handle it. Bring it on.
Okay. All right. So let's move on to the other questions in his email here. So really give us a little bit in terms of the difference between your normal and versus low angle planes. So we've talked about it a little bit. Let's get into the meat of it.
Okay.
Who wants to go first?
Matt, I took the first one last time. I took the first shot last time.
All right. Well, I have a feeling you and I will probably agree on this one. Dang it. really, when it comes down to it, the whole line of low angle planes that we have right now is it's pretty new. Historically, low angle was only – there was only really one low angle out there, and that was like the Stanley number 62, I think it was, the original like butcher block plane. Mm-hmm. And it just never went anywhere. So it was like the one plane, but now – suddenly, you know, both Lee Nielsen, Lee Valley, they both have full lines practically of all the low angle planes. If you compare low angle to the traditional beds, the angles of traditional planes, there is not really any difference as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't matter whether you go with all low angle smoother jack jointer or if you decide to go with the traditional ones. In the end, the results will be very, very similar. The one place that a low-angle plane will absolutely be of benefit is the fact that it's much easier. In fact, it's the only one that you can adjust the primary bevel on to give you a wider range of what you can do with the plane by adjusting the bevels, and this will kind of help to answer the high-angle planes. By adjusting that primary bevel will help you to work with different species of wood. Certain hardwoods need a higher angle to help minimize the tear out that you're going to get from it. So with a low angle plane, because the bevel is up, if you adjust the bevel on the blade of the low angle, you essentially will get this higher angle, which will help you to, again, minimize the tear out. So you can just swap the blades in and out, where with a traditional plane, you can't do that. It's stuck at 45 degrees. So you can change the bevel all you want, but because it's bevel down and it's the bed angle that determines what is the actual cutting angle, mm-hmm. it will always be 45. With the high angle planes, these take you more towards what would be like a scraper plane. So they're higher up, which then helps to, again, minimize the tear out. Sometimes I think what they're called York pitch. Isn't that one of them? Isn't that? Yeah. Lee Nielsen has an option for a York pitch, which is 55 degrees.
50, I think.
Yeah. Somewhere in that range. So when it comes down to it, really, let's just say that low angle planes and traditional planes, you don't need to have every single one of them. Really, you can choose and say, I want all the low angles because, man, they're really cool looking. They look like, you know, a Ferrari of the hand plane world. And the traditional ones look like my dad's, you know, Studebaker from way back when. So that's really I can see where it's confusing, because if you open a catalog and you look at it, you're like, oh my God, look at all these low angles. Oh, look at these traditionals. What, you have to have, you know, every single one of them? No, pick and choose like one smoother, one jack, one jointer. Mix and match, you know, colors, whatever you want, be happy. They all play essentially the same role.
Now, let me ask you, I think we have recommended in the past that if you're new, and a lot of people who listen to the show are relatively new to the craft, so they don't necessarily have the full selection. They don't have all different types of joiners, you know, in Schwarz's coarse, medium, fine categories, you know. So what would you say that the low angle might be the better choice if someone is just building their collection because of the fact that with the cost of just a second blade, they can get some increased functionality out of a single plane?
I think that's a very valid argument. And I've recommended that to people.
I think it's not even just the versatility of it, but there's fewer moving parts. A bevel up plane doesn't use a chip breaker.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, when you're talking about adjusting a bevel down plane, you have to move that chip breaker, you know, really close to the edge to break the chips faster for like a smoothing plane. If you've got thicker chips, like in a jack plane or even well, there's no chip breaker on a scrub plane, but if you're taking thicker chips, you got to move that chip breaker back from the edge. It's just one more thing to have to adjust, to have to make sure that you've tuned, that it meets the blade properly, all that stuff. A low angle bevel up, will just, it's interchangeable. I may say low angle, I may say bevel up, just ignore me, same thing. They don't use chip breakers. So to me, it's a heck of a lot easier. I would say if you're going to go out and buy only one plane to start with, I'm a big fan of the Veritas jack plane, the low angle jack.
Right.
It's just so blooming easy to use right out of the box. Those set screws help you control the blade movement, and you don't have to deal with a bunch of stuff. It's just really easy to work with. So,
yeah. With a low angle plane, especially the one that you mentioned, the jack, for the lack of a better term, as far as I'm concerned, it's like the Swiss Army knife of planes, because it is so versatile. You can do so much with it. And you're right, for the cost of just a couple of blades, you could have, three different planes, everything from a really rough, jack to basically a really nice smoother that you can dial in and just get some fantastic results with.
Yeah.
So it's a great way to go.
There is, I actually put something in the show notes here. There is a whole section in the forum on this, why bevel up, why bevel down.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a group of guys that are too blooming smart for their own good. I highly recommend checking this post out and follow the link to Conrad Sawyer's blog. Mm-hmm. Conrad Sauer?
Sounds good to me. Sauer? Yeah, Sauer sounds bad.
But Conrad's.
Anyway.
Sawyer.
Conrad's blog. This is one of those like pins or tails first type conversations.
Right.
Yes.
There is a lot of science behind this. And yes, there are reasons to say the high angle or the traditional planes should work just fine. They work fine for many, 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 many years.
Mm-hmm.
And as Matt said earlier, the low angle is kind of a newer incarnation, especially as we see it now. There are things called clearance angles, which is basically the clearance of the blade behind the edge, that you don't really get much of in a low angle plane, because your blade, the clearance angle on the blade is the same as the bed angle of your plane, in which case it's usually 12 degrees. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of space there, and that can cause issues when you're talking about fiber spring back. It can cause wear issues. A lot of people say that bevel up blades will wear faster, and they actually develop a slight bevel on the back of the blade, which can make it harder to sharpen. But I'm saying all this because, There is a lot of evidence to show some of this stuff, and there's a lot of really people who really know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And actually, if you go to Conrad's blog, people like Ron Hawk, like David Charlesworth, chime in. Larry Williams of Clark & Williams Planes, they all chime in on this blog post. So it's like,
wow,
the people who the, know what they're talking
the
about
dream team
are talking. Yeah, exactly.
You know what this is, though? This reminds me, it's like the equivalent of two power tool junkies, debating which saw is better because one of them is flat to the nearest thousandth and the other is flat to the nearest 2,000ths,
Exactly. I have a lot of each. I have a lot of traditional angle planes. I have a lot of low angle planes. I use my low angle jack plane from Veritas like every day and three times on Sunday. It's an incredible plane. But, I also have a couple of old vintage Stanleys that I use all the time, and I have a couple of wooden bevel down planes that I absolutely love. I just think that, really, we're really picking at really, really tiny little things here. Use what works well.
Frankly,
use what's easiest for you. I think that the majority of our audience, these are not guys that are, heck, even some of these professional guys are not using the planes enough that you're going to see these types of issues.
Sure.
We're just nitpicking too much. So before everybody who reads that post comes back and says, Matt and Shannon are wrong, there's real big different issues, I'm acknowledging the fact that there's always another story to this, but I just think, just go out in your shop and work some wood, people. Let's not talk about this anymore.
Yeah, and honestly, I got to say, I have the Lee Nielsen low angle smoothing plane, and every time I use it, I feel about 25% sexier. So I'm not sure where that comes from, but I love that thing.
One last thing, if you want to talk to somebody that will really kind of give you an idea of what you can do with a low angle, talk to Denim Pulowski.
Oh, what's his name at Lee Nielsen, right?
Yes, yeah. He pretty much every time I've seen him do something, it's always with his low angle jack. He swaps blades in and out of there, you know, like somebody in NASCAR, you know, changing tires. It's insane. It's amazing what he can do with it.
That would be awesome. He should just make the noise every time he does it.
In fact, from now on in my podcast, I'm going to dub that in.
There you go.
Awesome. Time to change blades.
Okay, real awesome. Quick, I did want to mention Adam's comments on low-angle planes, because he did address that, and he did include that as one of his things that you can skip when you're setting up your shop.
Yes. Well, and the one thing I'll say about Adam, the point that I loved about that post more than anything, is just pick the right wood. You know? Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you're trying to use crazy, you know, Australian jungle wood, it's gonna tear out.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you're gonna need to kind of tweak your bed angle and your blade bevel and all that stuff. If you use good hand tool wood, you're not gonna have these problems.
That, you can't overstate that. I mean, I know as I've gotten more and more into hand tools, I seem to gravitate more and more to using things like walnut and cherry and stuff that just, you know, tends to plane really well. It just makes the project so much more fun if you really do want to take more of a hand tool route. Just pick the right woods. You're absolutely right.
Right. There was a segue to woodworking in America. I know we're not there yet, but Brian Boggs did something in, was it the design conference? Matt, you were sitting next to me.
Yeah, that I was listening to the Amway's conference next to us. Apparently, right, Bonnie won bestseller for the Midwest.
Brian Boggs did a seminar, Woodworking in America, in the design conference on designing for your wood. Mm-hmm. And you know, as beautiful as his stuff is, I think honestly it's because he uses beautiful straight grain stock. He lets, you know, the curves of his design dictate it. And he doesn't use a lot of this crazy figured exotic stuff. And don't get me wrong, I love figured wood. It looks beautiful, but I just don't use it very much because it's a pain in the butt.
Yeah, it's not practical, you know, if you're doing a lot of the hand tool stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, we have another email here that I'll try to read quickly. This is concerning our previous discussion. You just mentioned some of the comments about, you know, designing for the wood. This is comments relating to our discussion about designing for the client versus designing for yourself. The Fine Woodworking article, I can't remember the exact date, but it was about the improvements that they were making to other people's designs. So this is kind of an interesting point from a designer, but not a woodworking designer, somebody who has experience in the world of design, but I believe it's like in web design or product design. So just a few interesting thoughts. We don't really have to talk about it much, but just to get you thinking. This is, by the way, from David Young. He says, first, let me begin by saying that I know next to nothing about the various styles of furniture. This is in an area where I do plan on spending time educating myself. I can, however, speak to design, as that is one of my primary fields of expertise, if there is such a thing. I think you pretty much nailed it when you said that design changes and or tweaks really do come down to individual taste, and you absolutely should take these articles with a grain of salt. The one thing I found in the 10-plus years I've been designing for clients is that it's very easy to go in behind someone on a finished product and say, I probably would have done this instead of that, or they could have taken this step further and done this with blah, 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 blah. I'm messing that up, but that's not important. Anyway, and I agree that these articles are fascinating, but at the same time, while not necessarily the case with the latest article, this method of critique can often brush over other constraints on the project, such as client input, availability of particular stock in the project time frame, certain space limitations, machining requirements, etc. We were just talking about using the right wood. For example, what was the intent? What was intended to go on that shelf in the entertainment piece, and how heavy was it going to be? If it was meant to hold a high-end home theater receiver, well, going thinner on that shelf may have made some pretty negative consequences down the line. Continuing on, sorry, this is a little bit long, but I think it's good. The one thing I absolutely disagree with on the article is the recommendation that you design to please yourself. As designers, you ignore the client at your own peril, and this is something I might have been missing from the podcast, and one thing I would hate for anyone starting in design to misunderstand. Yes, you can design to please yourself when you are the only one putting limitations on your design. However, when you are commissioned to design something for a client, you are expected as a designer to bring your design skills and sense of aesthetic, hereafter aesthetic ability, to deliver a quality product that first and foremost meets the client's requirements, whether starting from scratch or modifying something that they've shown you or provided you. Now, this can be obviously done in the design stages before anything is constructed, but reiterating what you said, design is about taste. Our taste, as designers may and often do, vary quite a bit from the clients that have hired us. Should we like the end result? We certainly hope so. Do we always? Absolutely not. It's just the subjective nature of the beast, so to speak. So thank you, David, for some interesting thoughts, food for thought there, and designing for, I guess there was a direct comment, he quoted it, designed to please yourself. So I think the problem is, especially with a magazine, they sort of talk to both audiences at the same time. So sometimes they may be talking more toward your hobbyist who's just developing skills. Other times they may be talking to, you know, more of the pro category, but you know, so
but even then, as a hobbyist,
yeah.
What did you tweet earlier this week, Mark, about wanting to sculpt the legs of that trestle table?
That's true. Your client is frequently someone in your own house, and
they usually wears the pants.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened. I wanted to sculpt the legs a little bit more, make them a little more round, go a little more intense on the roundovers, and I had only done the initial sculpting and the initial routing to create the roundovers, and I brought it in, and Nicole loved it, and she's like, "No, don't do any more. I like it the way it is." So, you know, I don't think this was a right or wrong thing. It was just where I wanted to go and where she wanted it to go. So, you know, I was happy enough with it at that point that I felt comfortable just easing the rest of the piece into what I had already done. So, yeah, the client won on that one, for sure.
Nice.
Okay, we didn't select anything. Normally, we take some articles and blog posts, but it looks like all three of us struck out there. So let's jump into the forum posts. And this was an interesting one. Let me copy this so I could see what the latest information is. The forum is pretty cool in that it also lets us do polls and survey people. So Muddler Mike, who is the happy owner of the Wood Whisperer Yak avatar, he put up a post that said, "Could you live without a table saw?" And we're giving Adam Carabini a whole lot of attention in today's show. He put up a post, and this is why this was really compelling to me. He put up a post a couple weeks ago, maybe even a month ago, a series of posts about the table saw and whether we really need it, considering how dangerous it could potentially be. Is it necessary? Do we have to have this tool in our shops, or are there other feasible ways to get the job done that don't involve the table saw? So Mike asked this question in the forum and did a little poll, and his choices were, well, let me go through what the results so far. The question was, could you live without the table saw? 18% said absolutely. 13% said, I like the idea, but having separation anxiety. And 36% said only if it was a last resort. That's the majority said only if it was a last resort. And 31% said, no way, you can have my table saw when you pry it from my cold, dead hands.
Nice.
So the discussion, you know, rages on there. So if you want to jump in, we'll give you the link for that. But really, really good topic. I don't know how much we want to go into depth on this other than to kind of go around the table here and say, you know, what do you guys think? Could you survive without your table saw? Matt.
I could. I probably would sweat bullets in a few situations, but I'm confident I could find a way around it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Definitely.
Shannon?
I was in the absolutely category.
Okay. That answers that question.
Actually thinking about selling it right now, actually.
Me, I was in the only if it was a last resort. You know, I really do rely on it a lot because it's something I've worked into my workflow, but if it wasn't there, I could probably find other ways that would, you know, work into my workflow, but I would be kind of sad about it because I do really, you know, not just because it has flames on it, but because I really do count on it for a lot of things.
And that's what it is for me. Mine doesn't have flames on it. So absolutely, I can live without it.
That makes sense.
If it has flames on it, totally different issue.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So
and,
yeah, check
and actually,
it out.
There was, there's a couple of really good comments on there on that forum post that you guys should go all read it. But one of the big things was for those that are like building a shop who've never had a table saw,
mm-hmm.
absolutely, piece of cake. But anybody who's actually gotten a table saw and has maybe come to rely on it, that's when it becomes really hard to say, let's walk away from this.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'll put the link to Adam's stuff too, because he took a very, very specific standpoint.
War on table
I mean,
saws.
Yeah. Talk about, you know, stirring things up. It was basically, you know, for the most part, calling for like, you know, outlawing the table saw or basically saying that the magazines and the media, it has the responsibility to show alternatives. You know, do you have to rip everything on your table saw? No, you can use your bandsaw. Let's look at some of the alternatives. So he has a very strong viewpoint. I don't don't even necessarily agree with them 100%, especially in the more you get into a professional shop, I think the more the table saw becomes important. But if you're really just in there working wood for the love of working wood, and you don't mind, you know, taking your time and learning some other processes, they happen to be safer processes as well, there's really nothing wrong with saying, forget about the table saw.
Right. So with that idea, I threw a link in to something I found on the forum, like way back in the early days of the forum. And Jason Straw put a link to one of his YouTube videos. He's building this just crazy marquetry set of tables. Mm-hmm. And I found it really interesting because I was just reading through the posts on that, can you load that a table saw? And here's a guy that at no point in this video did he use a table saw. Now, it's no wonder he's a graduate of the Redwood College of the Redwoods, Kernoff School. And Kernoff, I don't think, owned a table saw. I could be wrong there, but, you know, it's all bandsaw work.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like watching a Maloof video or something like that. He was shaping these legs. It's all done with the bandsaw.
Wow.
And I just found it really interesting. Here's a guy that's produced just an amazing table. And, you know, because of the fact that, sure, there's a lot of curves and a lot of kind of free form lines in there. But, you know, the table itself is, you know, straight lines and square. And you never see the table saw at use. So there's a good example. Plus, it's just a really cool video. It's somebody that should be applauded for really taking good quality video and getting really good camera angles. And, you know, the film guy in me kind of loves that. So
I
go check
this.
It out. His website, by the way, is pretty dang cool, too.
I missed it somehow. I don't know how. I mean, when was this posted? August 28th?
It was like
28th?
Because I specifically like went into the general woodworking section and like clicked on the last page.
Yeah.
A few days after you launched this forum, and he put it in there.
Okay. Well, he's only posted twice. So I guess he posted it, came back and said, hey, thanks, and then left.
Anyway, cool. College of the Redwoods graduate. He makes some cool stuff.
I will be checking that out myself.
Very nice.
Wonderful. All right, moving on. What do we have here?
Well, actually, I just slid one from the forum.
Oh, I see it.
I forgot to put something in here.
Okay.
It was this kind of is something that we talked about even way back in the days of Safety Week. High school woodworker brought this one up, and it kind of caught my attention. I had to laugh about it. Girlfriends in the shop. And the discussion went from there. Apparently,
only when my wife's not home.
I was just going to say, I never bring my girlfriends in the shop. My wife would be very angry.
Yeah, that my wife would definitely notice the high heel marks walking through the sawdust, and they're not mine. I only wear flats. But essentially the question kind of, it brought up that whole topic of people coming into your shop unexpectedly. And I know that we've talked about, I think you did a whole thing about it during safety. I think both of you did.
Yeah.
The discussion of, you know, something has to be set up so there's an understanding of when it's safe for you to come in, when it's not. And I know in my household, we definitely have the rule of you hear the noise, you stand in the door, unless, of course, the noise involves dad screaming for help, in which case it's okay to come running in. But I think it's pretty neat because as you go through this, you see how this works for everybody. This is such a common thing, and everybody has their different view of it. Like, well, I want them to come in. I want them to experience it. I don't want them coming in because I don't, for this reason, that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Did anybody
say
those...
when their girlfriend's in the shop, they put a sock on the door?
No, it was the apron strings
there
on
you
the
go.
Door.
Put the apron on the door. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the shop belt with the hammer in it.
It is kind of funny. I mean, because I first saw this post and what, you know, the post is girlfriends in the shop. And I'm like, didn't we just do a post that was dogs in the shop? The timing on it was pretty funny. But you know, luckily, I won't say luckily because I don't mind Nicole coming in there, but I can't get her to go in there for anything. She, you know, like if I want to show her something, she'll peek her head in. It's just too dusty and, you know, doesn't want to trip over something or, you know, stub her toe on something. So she doesn't really care to go in the shop very often. It's all good. Yeah.
It seems like the only time my family really wants to pop in there is when I have the camera going and they've heard me on, like, you know, the 10th take. And then they love to pop their head in and just stare and occasionally run through.
Just to make you totally uncomfortable. That's always fun. Nice.
So,
okay,
yeah,
cool.
We'll have to link in there. That one. That one's kind of interesting. And it seems to have gone on for quite a while. I noticed
it did,
it's
yeah.
like one of those three pagers.
All right, yeah. All right, we got a couple of voicemails to run through. Our first one here is from Earl in Canada. And I'm waiting for quick time to load, so bear with me for a moment.
That must be the Canadian version.
Yeah, what is the deal? Yeah, no, hey. no problem, computer. I'll wait. Okay. Here we go.
Good morning, boys. It's Earl from Alberta, Canada calling. Got a question for you about wood finishing. I build a ton of smaller projects for the home and normally finish most of them up with a Danish oil followed up by a wipe-on polyurethane. And most people like the looks and it stands up well. But I'm having some problems with a few of the exotic woods. A lot of them finish just fine, but namely things like Paduke, Kingwood, Coco Bolo. I'm having problems with the polyurethane not setting up at all and not curing. Even especially the Paduke, after a couple of weeks, it just wipes right off, doesn't set up at all. Looking for an alternative, what I can do for finishing on these. Some of these get handled quite a bit, so I'm looking for something fairly durable. Can I maybe seal them first before doing a polyurethane or an alternative for finishing them? You guys have any suggestions or comments? That'd be awesome. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right. I know you guys know the answer to this one. Common issue.
Yep. Wipe it down with mineral spirits, remove the oil, seal it with shellac, and then put your finish on.
Word up. Booyah.
Yeah, or just go with a more domestic wood like pine or cherry.
There you go. That's true. Use the right wood, right? Yeah, this is one of those things. This is very, very common. Any of those oily exotics are going to cause problems for your oil finishes. It's just not going to allow them to cure properly. So you do have to seal them up with some shellac, and de-wax shellac is always your best bet. You probably, if you wanted to, depending on what he's got access to, he could go with something like a pre-cat lacquer if he's looking for something that's a little bit more durable, and I would probably still give the surface a quick wipe down with acetone or denatured alcohol or something to kind of break down any surface oils on it, and then go ahead and spray it with some lacquer. That should do it too. But it sounds like if he's already on the path of oil finishes, he might want to seal with the shellac. And I would probably avoid the Danish oil because you got a little bit of a boiled linseed oil content in there that's going to make it even more difficult. So go with a pure polyurethane or some sort of varnish on the surface, and I think you'll be fine.
We, you know, here's a follow-up question, and I'm going to take this actually from the chat room itself. What's a good reference for what wood species are oily? Do we assume that an exotic would be oily? So if anybody else ever runs into this, I mean,
it's a safe bet. You know, if you're dealing with it and with an exotic, it's a good bet that it's going to be oily and you're not going to hurt anything by taking the proper precautions. But, you know, you can kind of look it up. But there's a lot of resources that will break down the different wood species and give you an idea of whether it has a high natural oil content and will cause finishing problems or not.
Gotcha. Basically, any hardwood that works at McDonald's is oily.
that is true. Oh, show.
You're on the...
Da-da-da. All right. We got another voicemail here. This one's from our buddy Roberto, who unfortunately has had some bad things happen in his shop. Let's hear about it.
Hey, guys. This is Roberto from New Mexico. I have a heartbreaking story that I need your help with. I was gone out of the state for a little while, and it rained a whole bunch here in New Mexico. There was a small leak in my garage roof where I have my workshop. And a whole bunch of water collected on the bed of my jointer. I came back after 4 days, and it is just half of it is full of rust. And I almost cried. I actually think I shed a tear. But I need your help now. How do I remove that rust? Should I get steel wool? Should I just scrub it, WD-40? You know, a steel bristle brush? Let me know. I'm in desperate need here. Thanks.
That is a real bummer. My first bit of advice is move quickly and don't let that rust sit there any longer than it has to. Do something.
Absolutely, yeah. You get that surface rust off and see how deep it really is. Yeah. Sometimes just being able to brush enough of it away, hopefully at that point you'll see how deep the penetration is going on and try to get something in there to just pull that moisture. I'm actually, Roberto, I am shedding a tear for you.
Yeah, that's
I know
terrible.
You don't want to cry, but I'm secure enough with my manhood, I can.
We promise not to cry on the iron, though.
Well, I mean, it really depends on how deep it is, right? Because surface level rust, you know, if that's all it was and he caught it quick enough, then he might be okay. But man, if he was gone for a couple of weeks and this was just left uncontrolled, you know, that could be bad news.
Yeah, so my first suggestion is just that. Just get the surface rust off. Maybe take like one of those like Scotch-Brite pads, something like that. Just just enough to start removing a little bit, get a layer, see how deep it really is.
See if you can get down to clean metal.
Yeah, exactly. And go put some molasses on it. That will help to eliminate. No, I'm just kidding. But get that off there. And then at that point is then when you're going to take some sort of penetrating oil. That point is when you want to start putting something like one of those top coats on, either like the T9 if you go in that route, or what was it, the top coat, the one from, you know, I can see the can.
Oh, the Bow Shield and top coat stuff. Yeah. Well, what if it's really deep? I mean, we know surface rust, you could clean it with a little WD-40 and you know, one of these abrasive pads. But what about the deep stuff? What do you guys recommend?
Well,
I've tried the other T9 product, the rust free. I've used that, but that's one of those that hopefully you have a very well ventilated area, or you like having the nose hairs in your nose burned out for you, because that will hurt quite a bit. And then that's a matter of letting it sit on there, penetrate. You know, you don't want to sit too long, because I think they have a time limit on there that they would recommend.
Yeah. What about that evaporust stuff? You guys tried that?
I would like to try that.
Yeah, I've tried it. That would probably work pretty well. I mean, it's not going to get everything off. It kind of blackens the stuff as it chemically reacts with it. The only time I've had experience with like really deep rust and like pitting rust is restoring things like saws.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually got they're called rust removers. I think you can get them actually at Lee Valley. You probably can get them in auto body shops. They're like little sanding blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And they come in different grits, and they actually have, they're impregnated with some kind of rust removing type thing. So it's like, take a little one of those sanding sponges things and, you know, soak it in Bow Shield or something like that for a while. And I mean, it pulls stuff right off.
Wow.
And you know, there's the abrasive action of it, so it's already helping to remove some of the stuff. So I think the idea is, I mean, you're not going to be able to sand at those pits. I mean, you're having to talk about taking down the entire surface to the bottom of that, but you want to get the rust out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So that at least, you know, cause rust is, you know, just keeps eating. It's like a virus or something like that. So once you get it out of there, then you can protect it and cover it.
Yeah, yeah, it's bad news.
One thing at this point, this is definitely one of those. I think if you take the time to do some preventative maintenance and to occasionally go in there, depending on where your tools are, like if it's out in the garage, if it's out in a location where, you know, there's a good chance of having some moisture being thrown at it or around it or something.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those great stories where if you do the preventative measures ahead, hopefully if you had some sort of protective surface on it, you know, you did a wax job once in a while, you did have like the T9 or something on there, that would help to minimize, you know, what's going on. I mean, it's not going to stop it, obviously, but
better than nothing. At least
give a little layer.
Yeah, definitely. Well, hopefully that'll work out. Definitely let us know, Roberto, how it turned out and what you wound up doing and how it worked. But one thing's for sure, I don't think his tables will look the same when they're done. They're either going to be darker, they're going to have, you know, sanding marks and scratches, but as long as overall they're flat, you know, who cares? It's fine. All right, one more voicemail here from Bobby Slack, who's making quite a noise in the forum. He posts a lot. He seems like a good guy, though. All right, let's have a listen.
Hey, Mark, Matt, Shannon, my first voicemail. This is Bobby Slack, Gaucho Woodworking. I posted in the forum some pictures of the piece that threw me into avoidance behavior. So a question in the finish. I posted the comments there. Do I go dark on the desktop like a chocolate, and then I put the plugs in the clear finish and the rest of the plugs in the rest of the piece in dark, like the countertop, or I do the countertop light with dark plugs? That's the question. I'm trying to make it short. I know I'm terrible. Goodbye. Hey, thanks for the forum. Thanks for the Wood Whisperer. Thanks for Matt Basement Shop. Thanks for all your great content. You're an inspiration. Take care. And Mark, if I would have saved a lot of money by not watching your great content. This is Bobby.
Sorry about the tool bill there, Bobby. But we all go through it, right? All right. So I had to go back to his post just to figure out exactly what he was talking about. And I'm still not 100% sure. It looks like he has a Alder face frame for some sort of built-in. And mm-hmm. he is screwing the face frame into the carcass, and he's got holes that he is plugging up. So his question is, what should he do about those plugs? Because it sounds like he wants to maybe allow them to sort of be an accent as opposed to trying to hide them. Or should he be just staining them all the same color and just kind of mask the whole thing? Is that what you guys got from that?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yep.
Well, okay. It seems to me if he stains the whole thing, the plugs are going to stand out anyway because they're ingrained.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to soak up a heck of a lot more. They're going to be darker no matter what you do.
Well, he was talking about going to ebony. You know, he's really looking to go dark. So they, you know, okay. With ebony, it's still, you know, you're still going to see them, but it may not be as bad as if he went with something that's like in a medium brown color where the end grain is going to get really dark brown. So it's kind of tough because I'm not 100% sure that the differences here are pretty dramatic. Like whether you go dark with light plugs, or one of his other ideas was go light with dark plugs, those are two very different things. And it really, that's a personal taste thing. But my suggestion, I mean, the thing is, I really, unless the plugs are essential to your design and something you absolutely want to be able to see, it sounds like he wants to go into the darker realm of color. I would say just, you know, put the plugs on, trim them flush, sand it, and then I don't know why he's not just staining the whole thing in place and staining it one consistent color. You know what I mean? Or possibly, if that end grain is causing the problem, maybe he wants to go to a medium brown or something, just use face grain plugs. Get a set of a plug cutter set and cut your own plugs from that instead of using dowel stock. You'll wind up with much more consistent results, and you can actually very easily hide those plugs instead of calling attention to them.
Well, actually, he's in the chat room, and he says he wants to make the plugs pop, so that was part of it.
So then Endgrain will do that. Well, I think he's got to go lighter with the background wood. Here's the thing. If he goes with a medium brown stain, they will darken, right? I mean, that's what Shannon and I were just talking about. So the end grain naturally is going to soak in more stain, and that's part of the joy of doing it that way. So maybe do some test boards and see what you think, Bobby, see if that works for you. But it will be several shades darker if you do something like that.
I don't know if it's like, you know, an essential design kind of whatever I'm talking about here, design principle or something like that. Or it seems to me the knee-jerk reaction, I know for me, when you look at a piece, is always to try to take those accents and make them darker than the background.
Yeah.
So if you were to take them and then make the plugs lighter, I think it would almost detract a little bit. It maybe come across a little gaudy. And again, I don't know whether it's like human nature wants it to be, you know, darker.
I think
to have those plugs a little bit darker.
I think I agree with you. I mean, there's something about it that makes it look like something's missing.
But there's something like ingrained in our DNA to say it shouldn't be lighter than the background.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, that makes sense.
Where's George Walker?
Yeah, where's Walker when you need him?
Well, he'll be at WIA. We can ask him then.
There you go. Yeah. I think that's pretty. I'm trying to read the chat, but it's moving kind of quick. I can't tell if we, you know, sufficiently answered his question, but that's how I would do it. And and you know what? Not to mention trying to go lighter would be really tricky.
Yeah.
How do you pull that off and wind up with flush plugs?
Like trying to do federal stringing and inlay. I mean, you have to go back with like a tiny little paintbrush and shellac all the inlay.
Right.
If you've got like holly inlay on a mahogany drawer, you can't just throw a finish over top of it. You got to take like a tiny, fine pointed paintbrush like you would use to paint like Warcraft miniatures. There you go.
Ooh, yeah.
And go over it with shellac in order to seal that so that it doesn't absorb any kind of dye or stain that you put on top of the mahogany.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's why whenever I do like a decorative inlay, I absolutely make a point that it's not going to be a stained project because staining is just going to throw everything out the window. It just makes it a real pain in the butt.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. We've got a Tom's tip to finish up the show here with. Everyone likes that. I don't have Carrie's tip this week because I forgot to ask for one. So maybe we'll get her to do one live for us at WIA.
Oh, that would be cool.
Oh, you know what? We're moving really quickly, and I forgot. I must not have even put it in here. Let me play this tip, and then we'll go back and talk a little bit more about WIA.
Didn't we want to talk about Woodworking America?
Yeah, I guess I mentioned it at the beginning, but I forgot to put it in later on in the show notes. So let's play Tom's tip. I'm going to go get my little itinerary, and then we'll talk.
Tom's tips. That's right, I said Tom's tips. I didn't say Tom's lips. I said Tom's tips.
Hello, everyone. It's Tom Iovino from Tom's Workbench, and it's time for another one of Tom's Tips. If you plan on working on a job using large sheets of plywood, there's one tool you should get your hands on. Head to the drywall area of your home improvement center and pick up a drywall T-square. The head of the square registers against an edge of your plywood, and the long edge gives you a great line to mark against. This way, you can make sure your marks, and hopefully your cuts, end up nice and square. The best part? They cost all of about $10. Not too shabby. Are you looking for a good time?
Yes.
That involves woodworking?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, who isn't? You can connect with woodworkers from around the corner or around the world at the WoodTalk Online community. Just visit woodtalkonline.com and let the fun begin.
Yeah, let it begin, like Tom says.
Yeah, when is it going to start? I'm
so much fun. There's so much fun. All right, so let's talk a little bit about WIA. That's coming up this weekend, and man, I would have been upset if I forgot to mention that before we close up the show here. So when are you guys heading out there? You're going to arrive on what, Thursday, both of you?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, we're going to be there Thursday night.
Me too. Okay.
That's the thing, I don't get lost.
So this is what, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday are the three, you know, days of the show. There's all kinds of events, you know, before, after, during, and around the actual classes and demonstrations and things. So there's so much going on. This is the thing to attend. Like, if you're going to anything woodworking related this year, you want it to be woodworking in America, right?
Absolutely. This is going to be the, I mean, they're making this so much bigger than the last two, well, technically three, since there was two last year.
Yeah.
This is gonna be really interesting to see how it's going from kind of a small little quaint family reunion type thing to, you know, bringing in the whole entire city, basically.
Are you concerned about that at all? Do you think that could be a bad thing?
To be honest with you, there is a part of me that is a little concerned, because going from the very first one, where it was really, really small and intimate, it really felt very family oriented. I mean, we all had this huge dinner inside of a little gymnasium, mm-hmm. where you pretty much do everybody. I mean, high fives down the walkway as you're going back and forth between classes. Last year's very similar. This one is like going from that small little tiny one classroom, school to now it feels like I'm heading off to the giant university.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm hoping that my nervousness for it is completely just me being a complete moron, which is pretty normal. So it should be okay.
Before we get into talking about the different classes and what we're taking, I wanted to see if you guys thought that this is kind of a weird situation, because this is a huge thing. Woodworking in America can't be, you know, you can't deny it. It's huge, and it's becoming bigger. And every year, I think this is something we're going to look forward to going to. And I, at least from what I've seen, please correct me if I'm wrong, but because this is basically run by Popular Woodworking, there's complete silence on the topic from Fine Woodworking or other magazines, right? I mean, have you seen anything?
Yeah.
So let's what a weird situation, right? They have to basically pretend this major event in the woodworking community is just not happening.
Yeah, it's really weird, because this is one of those things like AWFS you would expect to see plastered everywhere, and instead it's like Popular Woodworking. And that's about it.
Well, and for woodworkers, this is a much bigger deal and much more important and much more useful than the big tool shows. The tool shows are really about the tools and the manufacturers. This is really about the craft, and well, it's a little bit about the tools too, but the stuff we can actually buy, you know, whereas the big tool shows, most of it is stuff that's, it's not meant for us. So, you know, we're kind of trying to fit a square peg into a round hole when we go to those shows. But this is exactly what we want out of a woodworking show. And I just find it really interesting to watch the dynamic where no other magazines can talk about this huge event because it supports the competition.
Yeah. Well, it kind of makes you wonder too about some of the kind of fine woodworking writers, you know, the Garrett Hacks and the Christian Bexforts and guys like that. They're just incredible resources and incredible teachers for that matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, they're hands off. I mean, you talk about, if you want to learn about shaker furniture, how cool would it be to get Christian Bexford to come to this? But that's not going to happen.
Right.
He's on FWW's payroll. And it's interesting because, I don't know, I mean, not even part of the woodworking. I mean, why would they bring it up? I guess it's their event. But, you know, it seems like we've just kind of ignored the fact that, you know, there are other magazines, Wood Magazine and, and Woodworker and all those things.
Right.
Woodworker's Journal. I don't know. All those magazines I don't read.
Don't. Well, I mean, and at some point, it seems like they're going to, as part of being, you know, especially in the web community and blogging, certain things happen and certain things have to be reported on if you want to, you know, keep people abreast of what's going on. Ooh, I said breast. Keep people, you know, informed on what's going on in the community. It just seems like as this event gets larger and larger and more manufacturers are going to it and it just becomes this huge big deal, it's going to be really awkward when they just don't say anything about it at all. And here's the thing, because it's associated with the magazine, will a particular person be restricted, like you were just saying? Is that person really restricted on being able to go to a live event if requested because they write for a magazine? You know, right. And it seems awfully limiting because they can go to other live things, they can teach, they can go to schools, they can do whatever it takes to get paid, as long as it's not writing for another magazine or another publication. So this isn't writing, it's a you know, going someplace. So I almost think that those people should be allowed to come to this event, but will they be restricted? I'm sure they would get pressure and have problems.
Seriously, what would happen if Asa Christiana tried to register for classes? I mean,
as long
frankly,
as he doesn't get one of my spots, he should be okay.
Right. If it were me, if I worked for Fine Woodworking, I would go. I would attend as an attendee. You know, I mean, it's a perfect opportunity to go into the competitions camp and see what's going on.
Just see what's, you know, an inside look. Why not? But I think, you know, they're a prideful bunch. I don't know that you would necessarily see any of them say, you know, it's more of, I don't know, maybe head in the sand, or let, you know, I'd rather ignore them rather than to give attention to them.
The thing they can ignore is what this is doing for the vendors, for the manufacturers, especially now that they're bringing power tools in on this particular conference.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is a huge event and a huge moneymaker for guys like John Economaki and Joel Moskowitz. And now that they're bringing, you know, these power tool guys in, you're going to see Powermatic there. You're going to see General there. Actually, I don't know if Powermatic's going to be there or not. Mark, you would probably know. But I know General's there because they're donating all these tools and selling the show, the ones they use for the show. You can get like a deal on General table saws, the ones that they use at the particular show. So now Popular Woodworking is locked arms with manufacturers, and the manufacturers freaking love them at this point. So now when you're trying to go and sell ad space in your magazine, and, you know, they're thinking, all right, well, you know, Popular Woodworking put on this great show, let's spend our ad dollars on them, you know?
Well, and you also think about, you know, outside the box thinking in how a publication, and this, you know, this broadens out to everything in terms of print and how different, you know, print publications are going to start doing things to survive. And think about it. If this becomes a major revenue source for them every year, this could be something that keeps Pop Woodworking around for a long time, you know, where other magazines may not come up with some really cool thing that makes them money and they wind up, you know, folding.
Yeah.
It's possible. Well, you never know.
Then again, I hope that Popular Woodworking is making money on this.
That's
you
true.
Know.
Well, if they're not, then they're bad business people. But
last year wasn't really well attended, so it makes you wonder.
Yeah.
I think that's why it's in Cincinnati this year. It's because it's a heck of a lot cheaper to not have to move 20 benches across the country and fly all these people in and all that stuff. So.
Right, right. Well, and you know, the good thing about this, and although I just made, you know, a joke about saying they're bad business people, the one big thing is I think there really is a true focus on what's important to the people who are attending. Regardless of profits, regardless of what manufacturers we can get to this thing, who's sponsoring it, all that crap, it still seems like they are really truly dedicated to just getting the stuff that we want to learn, you know, and getting opportunities for learning that we don't normally have access to, all in one place, all in one weekend is a pretty incredible feat. So kudos to them. You know, this is looking like a really big deal.
Sure.
You know, what I think is really neat is on top of it, you know, you not only have the vendors coming in, but what they have all the free things going on there too, with actual like free classes. You know, this is kind of funny because if you think about it, you have these paid classes and you have the free classes, and the free classes go on the same time as the paid classes. So you might see some people who are taking the paid class go, man, I'm going to get that free class. It looks kind of cool.
Right.
And speaking of which, go check out Joel Moskowitz doing freehand sharpening. He's got a killer way of sharpening freehand. He's doing it sometime on Friday, but if you're going to Woodworking in America, figure out when he's doing it. And for that matter, if you miss it, go up and talk to Joel and say, tell me about it.
Mm-hmm.
He taught me at the Philadelphia Furniture Workshop, I don't know, whenever that was, like 2 years ago. It's a very, very cool, very simple way to freehand sharpen. It really doesn't take a lot of practice. So
wow, cool.
go to that. Do that.
Sounds good. So I wanted to ask you guys, not to make this long podcast go any longer, what class or, you know, class or two are you most looking forward to in your lineup?
Oh, boy.
I mean, I'm still looking at my list. I don't even know.
The one right off the top of my head, and it's kind of funny because of the fact that we are going to power tools, I'm really looking forward to Michael Fortune's setup a bandsaw for ultimate precision. And it's kind of funny because this goes to that whole issue of fine woodworking, the other magazines and stuff. I'm familiar with reading his articles in Fine Woodworking, and he's had, you know, a number of them about using the bandsaw in those magazines. And here he is at this conference doing pretty much the same exact thing. So that's one of them I'm really looking forward to. And it's kind of funny because when I think of woodworking in America, I think of hand tools. And the one I'm absolutely looking forward to is a power tool one. So I feel dirty about that somehow.
Well, I'll back you up on that, Matt. I think I was looking through it, and I've got a few that, you know, in the hand tool side that I'm really looking forward to. The draw knife one is one that I'm really excited about. I have a couple of them. I played with them all summer long at the Stepping Stone Museum, but I know very little about them. But I'll tell you, doing inlay, Glenn Huey's thing on string line and barrier inlay using a router,
yeah.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they just posted something on that today. Glenn put his Chester County Chester drawers that he did at Acanthus Workshop this summer that they're doing, I think, in the December issue. And so I guess for those of you, Vic, that can't make it to Woodworking in America, that particular class will be discussed in the December issue of Pie by the Woodworking.
Nice.
But that looks pretty cool. I'd love to learn how to do that with a router because I've only ever done it with like a scratch stock.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. Do you guys know, are all the classes set up so that like the first hour is essentially a lecture or a presentation and the second hour is an opportunity to do hands-on if you want to?
Yes.
So every one of them is set up that way.
Yeah, right. And they did something like that at the last hand tool one where you had like a follow-up session. But what's cool is it's all in the same place this time. Mm-hmm. Because, God, I remember in Valley Forge, I mean, I lost weight walking back and forth. You know, it was a huge trek from one side to the other. And, you know, you'd be in with, you know, pick your favorite. You'd be in with Adam Carabini. And then he would have like a Q&A session afterwards or what they call the hands-on session. But that was way down in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, frankly, logistically, you know, these guys were like packing up their tools and everything. They demoed on like a little cart and wheeling it down the hall. And, you know, it became kind of a nightmare. So you may not be able to get that like hands-on section until 2 days later. Whereas now it's like right after the course, which I think is pretty cool. I mean, me, for instance, I'm going to basically spend all day Friday with Roy Underhill. How freaking cool is that? In the same room, you know, saw sharpening, ripping, cross cutting, all that stuff. And there's each lecture. And then afterwards, go and do it. And I'm specifically bringing a dull saw to learn how to sharpen it. But I mean, how often can you say, I'm literally going to spend 6 hours with Roy Underhill working and talking with the guy? And actually, there was a question way back in the chat room before we started this about. Do people really bring tools to this? Jay Wagoner, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yes, people do bring tools. Not that many, though, frankly. And I think if you bring tools this time, you will almost assuredly get a chance to do the hands-on things. Because I think people are going to be wanting to do some things and having to fight over the tools that are available there.
Right.
Plus, I also see a lot of people like just kind of standing back and not really jumping in. So I would urge you, if you want to do the hands-on stuff, just do it. The instructors are there. They want to help you. They want to show you. Last year, Chuck Bender did something. He's like, I have no intention of lecturing, guys. You either ask questions or I'm just going to go sit down over here and take a nap. You know, it got people up to say, hey, okay, how do I do this? And, you know, the idea is lay your hands on the tools and just do some stuff with it. So bring your tools. I mean, I'm bringing some. Frankly, because I want Ron Herman and Roy Underhill to tell me how to sharpen my crosscut saw.
Right.
So,
I'm actually not bringing much myself, just with the air travel and all that stuff. I like to travel light. So, plus I've got...
If I were flying, it would be a different story. No question.
Yeah, that makes it a whole lot more of a big deal. Now, here's the problem, though. I don't know what I might be coming home with. So I may not check a bag on the way there, but I sure as heck may be checking a bag on the way back. But, I mean, looking at these classes, I pretty much packed my schedule. So I don't necessarily have anything blocked out for hands-on, you know. So I guess if I'm really, really intrigued and I get the opportunity, I'll just try and, you know, knock some people out of the way and steal the ones that are there for people to use. But I'm just not going to travel with them.
If nothing else, I mean, this is frankly, these guys don't really have anything planned for that extra session. It's kind of your time for Q&A. So, you know, now is the time. I mean, how often do you get a chance to talk to Frank Klaus about making dovetails or chopping mortises?
Yeah.
It's just a phenomenal opportunity to really be able to pick the brains of these guys.
That it is.
Do it.
Do it. Do it. Yeah. Well, I'll look at my list tomorrow and I'll see if anything is important enough for me to, you know, pack some stuff. But if I got to pack a bag anyway, then I may as well throw a couple things in there.
I'll be perfectly honest. Woodworking in America, as much fun as it is, it's extraordinarily frustrating at the same time because there's so much stuff going on. You can't help but feel like you're missing something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like it's going to be even worse this time around. So.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
All right. Well,
I just heard the TSA officer with you, Mark, at the airport. Excuse me, sir. There seems to be a tool in your underwear. What is this all about?
Dude, you should have seen when I traveled last time to Atlanta when I went to teach at Highland. The guy was just looking at the stuff and he just couldn't figure out what it was. I'm like, you know, and it was stuff that didn't even have any blades in it. Like the Veritas MK2 sharpener and some sharpening stones and things. And the guy's just inspecting everything. I'm like, I'm a woodworker. I'm like, these are sharpening stones. There's no blades in here. And it still took me like 20 minutes to get through there. And I should have just, you know, checked the stuff, but I don't like checking if I don't have to. Yeah, anyway, it's pretty tough. So, all right, let's close this out. If any of you are going to Woodworking in America, we'll see you there. So hopefully, you know, you should be able to recognize us. We'll be pretty obvious, and we'll probably be together many times. So don't
be the one walking around in circles.
Yeah, yeah. Don't be afraid to come and say hi to us.
He'll be signing autographs.
I will be hiding behind Matt most of the time, I'm expecting.
Which won't be very difficult considering the way I've been eating recently.
I'll be dancing behind Matt. You won't even see me. No. All right. So, Matt, you want to tell them how they can get in touch with us or whatever it is you usually say at the end of the show?
All right, no problem at all. So if you happen to want to get a hold of us for some reason, maybe it's something that you heard in the show, or again, maybe it's something you haven't heard, there's a couple of different ways you can get a hold of us. Number one, you can email us at woodtalkonline@gmail.com, or you can pick up the phone and leave us a message on our voicemail at 623-242-2450. And of course, you can get a hold of us on Twitter at MBWPodcast, at WoodWhisper, or at Renaissance Woodworker. Find us on Facebook and... You know, I definitely recommend you head on over there and do this. Like I said, you'll find one of us in there probably anytime during any day of any month of any year. Well, it hasn't been up a year. But anyways, woodtalkonline.com. It's the new forum. It's hot. You should be there because if you're not, you're a loser. So anyway, though, that's pretty much it.
If you can't reach us with any of those ways, it's puff, puff, poof, puff, and smoke. Smoke signal.
There you go. I never thought of that.
You know, and hey, while you're out there and you're going to email us, you should also comment on the fact that Shannon was wrong about the joiner fence, but we're just going to go ahead and leave that. We'll talk to you guys later. Bye.
Nice. Good way to close it. All right. Hey, I do want to mention that we will try to do a live, well, not live. I don't know if we're going to have the internet connection to do it live, but we will be recording some sort of a roundtable podcast type thing that's going to, of course, have me, Matt, and Shannon. We're probably going to bring in folks like Adam King, Tom Iovino. You know, maybe we'll get Carrie to join in if she's available. So I don't know how, when, or the way it's going to go down, but I'm going to bring everything with me, and hopefully we'll be able to have a little live in-person roundtable discussion, which should be completely awkward because we've never actually done this in person before.
It will be very awkward.
So, all right, thanks for listening, everybody. Chat room, we appreciate you hanging out with us, and I guess we'll catch you next time.
Thank you, everyone.